We're so intimate right now. It's very nice. I feel like...
Getting a little closer every week.
Yeah. I put on deodorant after work.
Welcome to Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
I mean, who wants to have sex with a guy named Bob?
Oh, Bob. Just doesn't sound right. Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh,
Bob. Bob. Bob.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
And that's Jaime. Protege of mine. Ranked number 32 in the federal prison system.
32?
That's right.
Out of what, 20?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com, IHateCritics.com, Facebook, our Twitter and Instagram handle is CriticsPod. There you can participate in our top fives, watch the trailers, read Sean's reviews, interact. Hell, if you want to post your own trailers, we'll watch those, because sometimes we just forget to post trailers to the last minute, so add your own trailers and we'll talk about them, maybe, depending on how crazy it gets.
Right. Or if it's an Adam Sandler trailer.
We'll definitely talk about that. Okay. I'm the one who reads them off, so we'll be fine. Yeah, the more you can annoy Sean, the better. More likely I'll read it off. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. And then Patreon, IHateCritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. We do have that bonus time travel episode that we will be releasing here soon. Once I remember, I just kind of forgot that we had it.
That's all right. It was just Josh's life's work. It's no big deal, though, really.
But I got it. I think we'll do half at like Halloween and the other half at Thanksgiving. Maybe.
The less you release of the show, the less of me like being in between you and Beth the whole time, like striking me down in all irrelevant points.
But it'll give you kind of a taste of what our Patreon episodes are at, and we probably need to do another one of those here pretty soon as well. But let's get to the news. Filmstruck.
Yes, the Filmstruck app is no more. This is part of Warner Brothers kind of culling their products. They've got at least three or four different streaming products that they already have, and they're kind of bringing those under one umbrella. But that's going to mean a lot of rough times for fans of movies like these that are part of the Criterion Collection or part of Filmstruck, you know, these older films that may not be popular enough to end up, you know, searched for in other ways. Like, Filmstruck highlighted a lot of different things that, you know, the work of George Cukor, for one, is one I've watched a lot of on Filmstruck, and it's going to be harder to find his stuff now. It'll be in the Warner, you know, like Warner Archive, or whatever it is that Warner Brothers is coming together with. They'll have this stuff, but it'll be in amongst so many other things. It's kind of going to get like Netflix, you know, where there's so many things, it's hard to find those little gems that are
there's so many
there.
Things you don't watch anything.
Yes.
That's me and Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, I watched a movie called The Clock not too long ago with Judy Garland. And unless you're searching specifically for Judy Garland, you're never going to find that movie. It's not a big hit. And I'm afraid that's what we're going to see. You know, Filmstruck was so wonderful for having those movies, and you know, Criterion, they could probably do their own, and or at least find another home that where they'll highlight them. They'll go back to Hulu, maybe, you know, because they were there for a long time and people could watch stuff there. But you know, Edgar Wright was talking about how, you know, this is why he keeps buying DVDs and Blu-rays, because he knows that this is coming, that this type of thing is the streaming services are getting so spread out by company that you can't keep all these streaming services, and having, and especially keeping access to movies like this that could just, I mean, there's millions of movies that just could just disappear tomorrow if somebody just decides it's not really getting watched enough, and it could be a great movie, but we'll never know. It'll just disappear into the ether because the streaming services are consolidating so much.
I'm so glad that you said the most important part of this story to me, because yes, hopefully things will take over in another place. I watched the French Donkey movie on Hulu, for example. That's where I discovered a lot of Criterion stuff. But the physical copies of things, I've always been a proponent of, I like to have something tangible, be it a book or a DVD or a Blu-ray, and I've been referred to as a hoarder or something like that. And I don't think that's fair, because I put things in very clear, organized categories where I can find them at all times. And I think this backs it up a little bit, because I've been told specifically at home, like, yeah, but it's in the cloud. Like, you just download it. I'm like, well, what if they take it away? What if Netflix stops streaming something? What if Amazon no longer offers something? You know, it becomes very difficult unless you have something in front of you. So I take very good care of my own stuff for this specific reason. 20-some years ago when I started collecting DVDs, the idea was that I thought that if it was mine, then no one could really take it from me. It was always something that I could watch at my leisure. It's something I can control.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because there are numerous people on Twitter who've reported having things that they purchased on iTunes just suddenly disappear. Even though you've bought the movie, it's no longer there. And if you didn't download it and put it on your own computer or save it to a flash drive or something, it's gone for good. And they're like, sorry, we just couldn't store it for you. You know, I bought the movie Peeping Tom. This is one of my all-time favorite movies. But there are days when when I'm looking through Amazon going, where are my movies that I bought from Amazon at? And I have to go looking through my Fire Stick trying to find the stuff that I've actually bought.
Yeah, I haven't had that happen to me yet. I mean, I haven't really bought anything through iTunes, though. Amazon, there's, at least on the app I have, it's pretty easy to see where the stuff, the few things I have bought is. But then again, it's mixed in with the stuff you rented. So, yep. Which is kind of, you have to go searching. I mean, it's going to be like with the music industry, the same type of thing. You'll get something like vinyl to come back. I mean, like, it's not like Laserdisc is going to come back or anything like that. But, I mean, your 4K stuff and Blu-rays are still going to stick around a little bit. But it's not going to be the mass thing anymore. You're still going to have your collectors. It's just going to get watered down like the music industry did. That's all that's going to happen. It's already happening. And especially with TV the way it is. And it's going to get to the point, like you said, where there's so many services. But at the same time, when you add all those services together, you got your cable bill. Mm-hmm. And that's it's going to go back to that. But there's going to be so much to choose from that, you know, it's already there where there's nothing that everybody watches, you know, like there was back in the good old days before us. let's get to our trailers then, unless you guys had more to add.
No, that's all right.
All right. Speaking of Netflix, Bird Box. Movie we probably won't ever see. But Sandra Bullock's in it.
Oh, no.
It'll get lost on Netflix when you're flipping through.
Josh will watch it.
Absolutely, I will. This is written by Eric Heisserer, who wrote Arrival, for crying out loud. Like, of course I'm going to watch this. I don't know what's going on, to be fair, in this trailer, but I don't care. I have a very... I'm interested. The title is a poor title because, yeah. I mean, it makes me not want to really get into it. But if it's awesome, then I don't care. Like, the first time I heard the title, The Big Lebowski, I said, well, that sounds really stupid. I don't want to see that. And then, like, I watched it again this week, and it's, of course, absolutely amazing. So don't judge a book by its cover.
I had my brother just kind of ruin this movie for me right before I got here. Actually, I almost forgot to tell you guys this. I was telling him about the movie, and he watched the trailer, and he says to me, isn't this just A Quiet Place for the Eyes?
I was just going
to
say that, yeah. That's what the trailer looked like.
Yeah. You suck, Kevin. Which
is probably why it's on Netflix.
But this is directed by Susanna Beyer, who's very, she's ambitious, but she misses a lot more than she hits. She did Serena with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, which was a big idea that was not very good. Things We Lost in the Fire is a really great movie, but that's the one really great movie she's made. And beyond that, she's just like, she misses. She just comes really close. It's big, always big and ambitious, but I don't know. I've yet to see anything she's really got it all together.
Thoughts?
He took my Quiet Place joke, so
it's my brother's fault.
That's all right. I mean, I don't know. I want to see it. It's just a matter of, I mean, it really is. I don't know when it's going to come out. Even if you tell me, I'll forget. And then it'll be something that I'll be searching through and I'll just be like, oh, I don't know what to watch. And then I won't watch anything.
That happened to me with that Jason Segel, Robert Redford movie a while back. I was interested. I wanted to see it. And then it came out on Netflix. I had no idea what day it was going to be there. And then I totally forgot it was ever there.
Yeah, his last movie, except for the one that you saw in theaters this week. But back to your thought of swinging big and missing, that sounds right up my alley. The three true outcomes movie. It's either going to suck, be awesome, or I'll forget about it.
Or you'll like part of it and forgive the bad part.
The Adam Dunn of films.
Man on Fire. Vox Lux? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, I think so. This is a pretty unique looking trailer. I had no idea where this was coming from. But apparently it's, Natalie Portman as Sia, I guess. It's Sia's doing the music, apparently. And she's playing, I think she's playing a pop star.
It appears like it.
Yeah. I wasn't really entirely sure. Who directed this? Did you see, Josh?
I didn't see either.
Oh no! This is a newcomer, so it's not anybody knows. So that kind of makes me nervous about it. But Natalie Portman's been shepherding this project for a while, apparently. So who knows? I don't know much about the music of Sia.
Her song at the end of Neon Demon is really awesome. I love that one. But beyond that, I just know one song that was already in my collection before she became like a thing, you know. I'm not trying to be a hipster here, but it does sound like that when I say it like that. But this film reminded me, I'm watching the trailer and I'm like, is this Black Swan 2? Because you can see a little bit of the DNA of Black Swan in this, and that you've got an artist that's kind of going down a dark path. But then there are some weapons involved in the movie. I don't know where it's going, but I'm interested enough to say, okay, sure. My only concern is just like when I watched the trailer for Bird Box, is this going to be readily available? Is this going to come out into theaters? It looks like something that if it does, it will be the CineArts release.
I think actually this is Natalie Portman. Natalie Portman's still pretty big. I mean, her lesser stuff even hits theaters these days. So,
I think it'll be a slow release, like a selected cities, and then come out like maybe a week, because it does look somewhat artsy. It's like kind of similar to that Jackie movie where that came out, you know, it eventually got here, but it took a while. Mm. Yeah. Maybe not, but it kind of looks like Black Swan meets Popstar, that Andy Samberg movie.
If they're going for Oscar, though, then it'll definitely be here. And I think I kind of got that vibe from it.
I think it'll be here eventually.
So another movie suffering from a title problem. I don't know. That and Bird Box.
I don't think it's about Sia, though.
But I don't think it's about her, but she is contributing the music.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, Iron Man 2 is not about AC/DC.
But this fulfills Sia's desires to not, like, be seen. So, you know, she's having somebody else play her. It's like an ultimate music meta thing going on.
One time I went and saw her in concert, but left before she came on because I only wanted to, I didn't know who she was. I just wanted to see the opening act.
Which was?
Chicago. Girl in a Coma. Look them up. They're awesome. Okay. They're not, I don't think they exist anymore. But anyway, I think it looks like a good movie, and Jude Law's in it too.
Yeah, so, frumpy Jude Law. That was weird.
But, I mean, like you said, Natalie Portman's been, whatever the word used was, really passionate about this project. And you can kind of see it in her performance, mm-hmm. So I'm sure it'll be good enough. Speaking of good enough, Hunter Killer.
That ringing endorsement of good enough, you know. What would be good enough for Hunter Killer? You know, I discovered about, I told you guys this, I've discovered something about Gerard Butler, that he is the Michael Dudikoff of this era. He's the shitty actor who takes on those terrible action movies that don't belong in theaters but end up there somehow. I guess because of, the modern day Golan and Globus that are running Millennium Films. But this is
more the Chuck Norris. I mean, I know you're good in that, but he is successful at least.
Well, Dudikoff was successful to a point.
Yeah, but to a point. Gerard Butler is a little more successful than that. I don't. He's like Chuck Norris successful.
Yeah, and Dudikoff has like no heartthrob thing going for him. He never.
Oh, no, come on. He was very handsome.
He's a good-looking man, okay? I wouldn't kick him out of bed. I'm just saying that he's not the afternoon like.
I think you guys were too young in 88 to know just how big Michael Dudikoff was.
You're right.
But you would think we would have retroactively heard about it.
He dominated the culture for a time.
There's no way he dominated anything. He didn't even dominate Roland Glomus. Chuck Norris did.
Or his own movies. His voice is too soft to dominate the screen.
But anyway, I get your point. So continue.
They're both terrible. They make terrible movies. And Hunter Killer is what? Terrible. Wow. What a surprise. Gerard Butler plays the submarine captain who gets his first command going to taking a Hunter Killer class submarine to Russia. He ends up with the task of trying to save the Russian president, who's been overthrown by his military leader, who's like the last build guy in the cast. So you know how seriously they're taking that villain. Big name, too, Michael Gore. Everybody knows that guy. That's the weird thing about this cast. Like, as much as Gerard Butler, I guess, is a star, he's a third of this movie. There are three parts of this movie. The other part is led by a guy named Michael Beeman, who is, I guess, the bad guy in Die Another Day, which, boy, that's a deep cut on Bond. He's also on some TV show, I guess. But he's playing the leader, the guy who actually goes in with the gun and actually rescues the president, not Gerard Butler. He's stuck on the sub. Then you've got Common and Gary Oldman, who Gary Oldman had a three-picture deal with Millennium that they basically held this one until after he won the Oscar. And you know how this, they know this was on the shelf because Michael Nyquist is in this movie and he's dead.
Yeah.
And he died more than 15 months ago. So this movie's been on the shelf for a while, just waiting for somebody to finally blow the dust off it and throw it into a theater for no good reason. It's the bad part about it is it's not even fun bad. It's the director is really competent. And so you can't really laugh at it too much. It's just, so basically it's just a lot of boring machismo, and that stinks. And everybody's too professional for it to be interesting. They don't care so much, but they're so professional that they're not necessarily bad, but the movie isn't any good.
What's the best part?
Probably the ending, because it almost looked like Gerard Butler and Michael Beeman were going to kiss. I really thought maybe that they had so much macho chemistry together that for a moment it seemed like they were getting romantic. But other than that, no.
Redefines the submarine movie.
I don't think that was their intent, but that's the vibe that I got. They'd gone so far over masculinity that it came back around the other way.
We all bring things to the movies, I guess. All right, then we can just move right along. The next most successful movie that's new for us is mid-90s.
All right, mid-90s. Jonah Hill written and directed from A24 in his first directorial effort. And this is a really impressive first film, that's for sure. This is a movie about a 13-year-old boy who was played by Sonny Soljak, who is basically just trying to define who he is away from his family. And this is something that you know, you guys are going to realize very soon, is that things that kids do, and I mean, you're obviously smart enough to know this, kids are going to define...
Thanks, Sean, for teaching us.
Sorry, I won't make my point here.
No, I'm kidding. The way you worded it was hilarious. You caught yourself midway through. It was funny.
The point is that kids are going to do things that are going to define themselves away from their parents, and it's going to be, whether you're a parent, and we are recognizing it or not, it's going to happen, and you just have to figure out how to deal with that. And there's a wonderful scene in this movie where it's the littlest thing, where Catherine Waterston just has this moment where he just says no to her, and she doesn't, and the hurt kind of ripples across her eyes because she realizes, even though she doesn't necessarily state it, she's recognizing that this is a different thing now. That my child has chosen to do something that's away from me for the first time. And that is such a unique thing for a director to capture so beautifully, especially a director this young. And that's what this movie is all about. It's all about that, this child defining himself away from the family unit, away from who everybody else was deciding who he was, and this is him deciding who he is. And that's really the crux of the film, and that's really what's so beautiful about it.
Yeah, oh, you're pointing at me, I have to go. Yeah, I mean, these are the types of movies where if I don't have any connection to it, I hate miserably. I would say the connection, though, is that I like Jonah Hill so much that I'm just curious how he wrote this and came up with this, you know? At times, I'll argue with myself, like, well, that scene you're talking about is fantastic, but there's not a whole lot of interaction between him and his mom. But then again, that doesn't matter, because it's really more from his point of view, and his brother and his mom just kind of pop up when it's... Because you're telling his story, you're not telling their story, mm-hmm. But it's neat because you want to know their story at the same time. I don't know. I ended up liking it a lot. I guess A Florida Project would be kind of something I'd compare it to. It was just kind of, I don't know. It's really short. It's really, really watchable. And even though it's the type of movie I don't normally like, I was just fascinated by some of the things he did, like, he really shot that. He really wrote those words down. He really did that, which I thought was impressive. I thought, you know, towards the end, how they showed the kind of the stuff that went wrong, the way he shot that, especially clearly with no money, was almost better than if he had $1 billion to make it. It was really effective. I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I thought it'd be good. But I kind of thought it'd be kind of like that last Zach Braff movie or something like that, where it's not for me, you know. It's that kind of, you know, moment in time movie, but I just don't give a shit about these characters. And I'm not a skater, never have been, not really a big hip-hop guy, so I had no real connection to that part of it. But I ended up finding it fascinating and really, really like it.
Jonah Hill seems to have his own voice, that's for sure. This is a hell of a movie, and hour and 24 minutes, sure, there's not a lot of room for additional exposition, talking about other characters, but in that hour and 24 minutes, I feel like I get a whole lifetime of age 13 for this kid. And there's so much to be said in here with the things that he doesn't say, with the things that the film doesn't talk about. We gather a whole hour and a half of our own thoughts. I have been away from the film for 24 hours now, and what I can say is that it's good because it's so honest. Like, you were saying that he actually shot that, he actually said that, or this character actually did that. There's an authenticity that seems cheap sometimes, like when they shoot it and it's like, oh, that's just shocking.
Right.
Right. And in this particular case, it's not shocking. It's authentic. And I really get behind that kind of a movie. And I have to hand it to Jonah Hill. He's never been one of my favorites, but I do recognize his talent, despite not loving Superbad, despite not loving him in a lot of roles. He's just a little belligerent and I don't quite get him. But this one shows me a little bit more of what he's about, that he really likes these kinds of stories, preferably, as opposed to what else he's doing, like the 21 Jump Street type stuff. This is more his wheelhouse, I think, if I'm getting it right. Now, there's a dynamic between the brothers here that's only touched upon, but we see it in such violent terms. And I was so taken aback by that, not because that existed in my life per se, but all sibling rivalries like that, right? You can get into fights, like wrestle around, whatever the case may be, but this is not a brotherly argument. This is assault, and the brother should be in jail. And I just couldn't believe how intense that was. And that makes a scene involving Lucas Hedges, when he no longer has the control, that makes that so much more potent. And I haven't seen that in a movie before. I really haven't. An honest portrayal of a guy that, it's not like he's cool. The movie isn't saying that he's cool at all, just because he has the Jordans, he has all the albums, and he's dressing well or whatever. They show him as inauthentic, in fact, in a couple of different moments, specifically the one that I'm talking about. There's a dynamic there of being a kid in the mid-90s. Say what you will about generations, be it baby boomers, millennials, us, whatever. But being the oldest kid in the mid-90s, man, I feel that guy's pain a little bit. Like, trying to look after a younger brother that's going off and doing whatever the hell he wants to do. And looking at a parent and saying, like, hello, hello, I can't do all of this, okay? So, by the way, I can say this now because no one's going to come back and get me on it. So I can talk about my parents' parenting all I want now. It's great. But in all honesty, this movie is honest like that. I don't know if he, because he's like, what, 32, 33 years old, something like that. It seems like he would have been more in the position of the title character than the brother, okay? If this is at all, in any way, autobiographical. But what he nails it, that's for sure. Whatever that dynamic is, that the only thing that I can control is this meticulously planned bedroom with my shoes the right way and my hats the right way. That's the only control that I have, okay? And then that's removed from it. That's the most powerful scene that I've seen all year long. And so this is a heck of a moving film. In a first-time filmmaker like this, you just never get that kind of thing.
I hesitated to talk about the brother because it's too real to me. My brother kicked the hell out of me, and it was perfectly all right somehow because he beat the hell out of me, and we have an exact 5-year age difference. So when I was 13, he was 18. He was out of high school the year I got into high school. But when you're when you have that age difference, when you have that 13 to 18 older brother, that older brother is, regardless of what he is to the rest of the world, he's a god. He has everything. He had everything before you. I had the extra part of that of my brother actually being super cool. He played a guitar. He had long hair. He had girls just falling all over him. So I constantly wanted to be in his room, but there was also that secondary part of it, is that no matter how many times he kicked the hell out of me, I wanted my brother to love me. I wanted my brother to be my friend so much, and it killed me that never happened. And to see the way that plays out between these two, that moment in the hospital killed me.
Yep.
It killed me.
It's tearing up
just
movie.
Thinking about it.
You can say all you want about it being a period piece about stuff in, say, 95, 96, whatever the case may be, the culture around skating, fine, okay, but really what it comes down to is, like, what's it like being this particular age at this particular time, and there's something to say about that, and he's got a unique voice for it, and I think he's right.
Oh, yeah, and none of this stuff is obvious, you know? It's not like he's spoon feeding it to you.
No.
You have to kind of figure it out for yourself. In a way, you're kind of the parent. You're kind of Catherine Watterson's character as you're watching this movie. Because there's times you're like, what the fuck? You know, you have this one good kid who's telling you what to do, and you're not doing, you know. He's kind of making his own decisions, and you're kind of having to live with it via him and his story. And I wouldn't even call it like an unreliable narrator. I just call it a teenager, you know, being the voice of the movie. And it was just really, really well done, pretty perfect, little tight little movie that, I mean, it didn't feel short, like, you know, too short. But by saying that, I don't feel like it felt long. It felt like a movie. But it's, I don't know. I think people should see it. And I especially think, I mean, if you grew up in the 90s, you're going to definitely recognize, you're going to remember talking like that and having, you know, conversations that you were around. Well, not all of that, because
not all that. This but, film goes way farther than I thought it might.
Yeah. Well, and then, yeah, there's
a character literally named Fuck Shit in this movie. That's his character name. This yep. movie, despite that, this is one of the most American French movies I've ever seen. This is a very French film. It's the way he shoots it, but also the very non-judgmental, observant way he allows these characters to just be. There is absolutely nothing in the way he shoots this that tries to push you in one way or another about how you're supposed to feel. And that is so, that helpless feeling of watching that little boy make those decisions. That scene with the girl in the bedroom is raw and uncomfortable, and you're supposed to be uncomfortable.
That was the main scene I was referring to, and I was like, he really wrote that.
He really did.
it's at no point did I sit here and I just kind of asked that question. I was never like judging him for writing that or coming up with that idea.
Yeah.
I was fascinated about, you know, where he got this, how much of this is autobiographical, if anything at all.
Yeah. I thought for a moment, like, this is too soon. He's what, 13? That girl's maybe 15 or whatever. And then I realized, oh shit, I should look back in my own history and realize he's already passed. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
that's something else. And it opens my eyes just a little bit more to what's coming. And I've prepared myself for some time. And like, my boy, a couple years ago, went off with friends at the fall festival that I took him to, and we were supposed to be doing stuff together or whatever, and then he saw a friend and was like, can I go ride with him? And then all of a sudden, I was by myself for an hour, kind of lingering on the outside. That's going to start happening. I get it, and it's cool, but I also just want to keep like a little, you know, touch the edge of his situation a little bit, so that if he's struggling, if there's something there, then at least I can access all of that because I've seen all of it. Catherine Waterson's character, I'm like, come on, get a clue. Oh, she's trying really hard, I suppose, according to her, but that's the problem, well, according to her.
Well, to the point, to your point of, you know, staying on the peripheral or whatever, it is a different time where if you're not, that's looked down upon. Back then, we could just go. There was no.
Yeah, we are talking about a low income, you know, family in a broken family. At that, the father is absent, and she had a child very young. So the movie's very non-judgmental of her as much as anybody else.
The movie can do that and does it well. I will sit on the sidelines and judge like crazy.
In terms of pure filmmaking, though, this movie is incredible for a first-time filmmaker. Just watch the little things, without ever saying it. He uses orange juice as one of the more important signifiers in the movie without ever stating it. There's nothing overstated about it. It's so brilliant.
He doesn't state anything.
Yeah,
that's what is really, really fascinating.
I wondered if that was some kind of like. Is that orange juice and vodka? You know, is this something that at the time was popular amongst certain circles that I didn't drink because I wasn't in those circles? No, it's just OJ.
No.
Right. And even using the 90s, they use it early on. I mean, obviously it's there the whole time, but early on, to the point where it's just like, he's just showing shit from the 90s, you know? But I think it's the kind of, I don't know, clearly it serves a purpose, and I mean, the 90s does kind of play a role in the movie in a lot of ways, which is kind of what I was going for with my top five, which no one wanted to play with. So fuck all of you.
Even those I did in my top five.
Should we jump to our top five? Or do you guys have more you want to talk about with mid-90s?
I could talk about that movie for a while, but...
He dies at the end. That may or may not be true. Either way, you're going to kill me.
Put your top five. Who's your top five?
So we have no other top five, so I'll just start with mine. Do you have yours available, or do I got to read
yes.
these two? Okay. I just put... I added mid-90s, but as my number five, I'd probably move it up the further I get away from it. Probably even to number three, maybe. Just in terms that really captured the 90s, but at High Fidelity, number four, Fight Club, three of the Big Lebowski, two Clerks, was very 90s, and I think the most 90s movies, American Beauty. Josh?
I kind of went with a list that made me
you feel about the 90s.
Feel like what the 90s were like, and so that means I'm going to Demolition Man. Alien 3. Not great films. It's ridiculous to even state that, but it's...
But it brings it you back to a time in the 90s.
In that mind frame, yeah. Like, as a teenager, but then, like, The Matrix, for example, was the thing that everyone in college was talking about when I was staying in the dorms for the first time. I didn't see it in the theater, had to wait till it came out or whatnot. And then I'm like, oh, crap, I should have seen this in the theater. And this is 1999 here, towards the end of the decade. But also... Wayne's World. That's probably the most quintessential 90s film for me. It's obviously not the best film of the 90s, but I watched it so many times, and there's so many things involving that movie that are like, oh, that's 1992, that's 1993, whatever the case may be, right at the time where I was starting to like get a clue. Well, okay, it's a long process, but you know what I'm saying. Like, at that time, I was starting to get it, and Wayne's World really was it. I have some honorable mentions on there.
You also
there,
forgot like, The Crow.
That was The Crow, yes. I'm sorry, thank you. That would round out the top five. But The Crow was that mid-90s. Like, I watched it in, I think, September of 1994, and all of a sudden I'm like, what is that music? And all of a sudden I started diving into a sect of music that I only spend like a little bit of time with.
In my top five, I started thinking of things that that reminded me of what was significant in the 90s. So I'm thinking my favorite would be Singles of those movies. Singles captures the moment of early 90s grunge music brilliantly, but also the era of filmmaking as well, because Cameron Crowe is incredibly talented. Primary Colors with John Travolta playing essentially Bill Clinton. I felt that was appropriately a 90s encapsulated well, and it's a good movie. It's a better movie than I remembered. South Park Bigger Longer Uncut came out in 99, really captures a moment itself, from everything from Saddam Hussein to just a number of different things. Then Bowling for Columbine would be another one, because you've got the rise of the gun culture and, of course, Michael Moore's prominence in that time in documentary filmmaking. And then if you want a documentary that is perfectly 90s in its way is Kurt and Courtney. The Kurt Cobain documentary, because it is both like fascinatingly of the culture, but also a complete lie. So it kind of fits right in with our mass media as it was rising into the internet age of the late 90s. That documentary is kind of perfect in that way.
The rise of fake news.
All right. Also out this week, The Old Man and the Gun.
The Old Man and the Gun, the final film from Robert Redford at the age of 82. He plays a character named Forrest, who's based off of a real guy. So this is based on a real story. It's directed by David Lowery, who did Pete's Dragon and Ghost Story. So he's kind of a varied career where you just don't quite know whether or not. I still don't know if he's a great director or not. This is a good movie, though. This is really good. So this guy Forrest is in his late 60s, and his hobby is robbing banks. Very politely robbing banks. He walks into the bank. He has a big smile on his face. He walks right up to the teller. He asks for the money, and he points to the gun and walks out with the money, because nobody ever suspects this old guy's actually there to rob anybody. Clever and it's funny, and he's so charming that you can't help, like, the tellers are charmed by him, and you're kind of charmed by him. Even the cop, Casey Affleck plays the cop, and he's kind of charmed by this old guy doing this. He was the leader of the Over the Hill gang, which in this case includes Tom Waits and Danny Glover as his cohorts in crime, which could not be more perfect as his group of three. He really did escape from prison 16 different times, including escaping from San Quentin in a homemade boat. He made a boat out of spare wood at the age of 61 and escaped from San Quentin. That's this guy. But this story centers on a relationship that he got into late in his life with a woman named Jewel, played by Sissy Spacek. And instead of just being like old people cute, like, oh, isn't it cute that old people are in love? This is just these two really have a serious amount of chemistry, and you're really invested in the two of them in the modest relationship that they build when Forrest isn't leaving to go rob another bank because he just can't stop himself no matter what he does. He gets into prison again and he's thinking already about how he can break out at 67 years old. And he finally, and you know, he's going to go back to bank robbing if he does because he just loves it.
So Robert Redford's still trying to play 20 years younger.
Even at the end.
Effectively, though, very effectively, this is a really good movie.
Yeah, if it wasn't such a crowded weekend in terms of my life, I would have, this would have been the other one I would have gone to, obviously.
Yeah, the fact that David Lowery directed it is kind of a big deal to me. I mean, I had no idea and should pay attention to these things then, but...
Yeah, I didn't. I just saw the name. I didn't even think to look at it.
I'm glad I didn't know before I went in because I would have been. I still would have been having some of that ghost story anger with me.
That was a hard watch. I tried so hard to make that movie good, and it just didn't happen.
The issue with that, more than anything else, was it was boring, right?
Yeah, oh, it was just super boring. Yeah.
Okay, time for a segue. Speaking of boring.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
I wasn't going to do that.
It's a mean segue.
Our undisputed classic this week is actually not boring. It's The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
You say so.
It's the least boring of the three, if I'm not mistaken. It's more fighting in it, isn't it?
Well, yes, this is the action.
You watched it, didn't you?
Yeah, but I haven't seen the third one yet, okay. So there might be more fighting in the third one. I've only seen part of it.
This is definitely, of the trilogy, the more action-centric and the most fast-paced of the three films. Be that as it may, 3+ hours, saying fast-paced is kind of a hard thing to buy, but... The Two Towers picks up where Frodo and Sam are getting closer to Mordor, and they come across the creature named Gollum, who's been alluded to but hasn't really appeared on screen yet. And when he does, it starts from there, and that's basically the movie, is Gollum. He's the star of the show. Andy Serkis gives an amazing performance. The CGI at the time was revolutionary. I didn't notice it like I noticed now.
Right.
And we're talking about Blu-ray, you know, high definition and all that good stuff. So I'm not giving it like the short end of the stick by any means. But it definitely looks weird. Now, this movie hinges on like a battle. And in the book, if you're familiar with the books, I haven't read all of the books, but I know enough about it to know. The Battle of Helm's Deep takes place early in The Two Towers. But in this film, it's more like the crux of the entire film hinges on whether or not... men from Rohan can hold this fort against an army of 10,000 orcs. So we're talking like between 300 and 400 people versus 10,000 genetically engineered super beings that are there to eat your face off. Okay, interesting. Aragorn is there, Legolas is there, Gimli is there, Theoden, the thawed-out king from earlier in the film, is there. There's a new character named Eowyn who tries to woo Aragorn, and so he's got a little bit of a problem. Do I take what's in front of me, or do I rely on the chance that I could get back with Arwen, Liv Tyler's character?
I feel like there should be, like, fife music playing behind him right now.
If you want to, like, mime a recorder or something, that might help. But you've got to admit, there's less walking in this one than either of the other two films.
Now, okay? If you're watching the Sam and Frodo subplot. Okay.
They
walk, and then they walk in a circle, and then they finally walk out.
Yes, they're walking.
Then they get marched by the people who capture them.
Yeah.
And then they walk back.
Yeah. Okay, let's... Nothing that you're saying is wrong. It's the tone in which you're saying it. Because you're saying something that's true, but it's still done well. Like, there's not a problem with this movie unless you go to some of the dialogue between Sam, Frodo, and Gollum. Like, especially Ooh. Sam and Frodo, that, you know, some of the lines that are given there are just like, oh, you mean, it's not really their acting. I suppose it's a problem. It's just the words are very corny.
That's kind of where I was at. I felt like, you know how, and I think we're on the same page when you watch a musical and they're singing to each other. That's kind of, and it takes you and I out of it. Sean loves it. I was just like, oh my God, Sean.
When he says, my Sam, oh good God. It's your Sam. I'm your Sam. Jesus Christ.
Well, they have a very close friendship. You know, hobbits feel differently than humans do.
Well, and it clearly works for its audience. I'm just not its audience. I mean, just like the way musicals work for their audience. It's just
You know what's weird, though, is that I came into Lord of the Rings not having read the books, okay? And I was more of a science fiction fantasy guy as opposed to just straight up fantasy. I never liked Dungeons and Dragons or anything that would maybe fit more into the Lord of the Rings realm, but I instantly hooked on to these movies, and I think it's so well shot, and the characters, they're just not crappy characters, you know? There's something to every one of them. Gimli has got his whole, like, gruff, I'm a small guy thing or whatever, but he's always, like, trustworthy, you know? It's typical character tropes, and everyone's playing, like, typical stuff, right? But they're all playing it on the same note. We talk about this often, about some people are in one movie, others are in another movie. Everyone's in the same movie here, and that's so hard to do when you've got a $100 million movie and, you know, years of shooting and whatnot. You can see how close the cast was and the filmmakers were when you watch these. And that makes for an enjoyable viewing experience, even if you don't like the over 3 hours, or even if you don't care for the My Sam stuff, which I can hear you fully on, okay? The Battle of Helm's Deep is a really neat piece of action, okay? The orc that's the kamikaze orc that goes in to blow himself up and the whole bridge, like, blows up. Visually, I remember looking at that for the first time and saying, holy shit, that's the coolest explosion I've ever seen on screen. And it is. It's still really cool. You can have stuff blowing up in flames all the time. That right there, that's a little more visceral and tangible to see, and all of a sudden the damage and the look on Bernard Hill's face, the actor that plays King Theoden, when that bridge goes, he all of a sudden realizes, oh shit, like the reality finally hits him that this is a battle that they can't win. So all of a sudden the heroism needs to be I lost him. I tried really hard.
That was accidental, and I tried to do it off mic.
It just worked really well.
For those of you who were listening and not watching, I yawned. But I wasn't doing it out of disrespect.
Of course
it's
not.
It's late at night.
It works really well, though, because I'm trying to be very enthusiastic about shit that you've seen 1,000 times before, but I have, like, a strong desire to love this, and I do. I mean, it's the only real fantasy story. You can't even really say Harry Potter is fantasy like this is, because this is like old-timey, you know, fantasy, epic fantasy that no one ever quite gets right. And I love, for example, The Neverending Story, which is basically Lord of the Rings Jr. It's the same structure, same type of thing, same, like, MacGuffin, you know. But this is just done so well, and it comes off of the screen. I love it. It's my least favorite of the trilogy. I can't wait to talk about Return of the King because of what it speaks to for me, but yeah.
I'm just unmoved by it. I really am. I find it to be awkward and uncomfortable, especially all the dialogue. And it's not a gay thing. It's just an awkward thing. It's a weird. I know this is how the characters are supposed to talk, but I can't help but feel like they just settled for that. Even I can't imagine that they were watching this or even saying it, going, "Are you sure about this? There isn't another way we can say this." It's just so weird and awkward. And I like how committed that guy. What's his name?
Sean Astin.
Sean Astin. I love how committed he is to it, but it makes it that much more cringy, just how deeply committed he is to saying things the way they say them. But I find the whole thing just it. It is so long, and I was feeling it. I was feeling it the whole time. I kept clicking the remote, just checking how far I'm in, and just throwing my head back and just kind of is that how I can't, it's another, there's still 90 more minutes. There's still 80 more minutes. There's still 60 more minutes. I really felt every inch of this movie.
Having seen it for the second time this week, did you like the Ents at all? The talking, moving trees? I'm saying this because as somebody that came to Lord of the Rings new and hadn't read the books the first time I saw the movie or whatnot, I thought the Ents were super cool. Like, it looked good enough at that time. And like, wow, the trees are taking their force back and everything. And of all of the fantastical elements to come out of this, like talking, moving trees was kind of the biggest reach for me. And they nailed it the first time that I saw it. Do you think that it's crappy or that it's worth it? Or
I don't. I guess I'm in the middle where I'm aware I'm not the audience for this movie. So it was never a. So it's clearly not cool. But I can't say that it's crappy or stupid. It's just I'm not. You know, I hear what Sean's saying, but that audience, they're in for that 3 hours, and they actually want more. They're the ones buying that six-hour DVD, and they don't really care. They just like to be in that world.
The most exciting part of watching it this week is when it said, please put in disc two. Oh, that was so exciting. You guys probably didn't have to do that.
No.
The extended edition, you have to put in a disc two. Oh, it was great.
But I mean, I'll admit, like Heat, for instance, I liked the fact that that was long. I didn't want that movie to end, and
absolutely.
So I get that feeling. It's just, and that this movie's audience, that's what this audience is into, and it captures everything the way it should. And I don't think, you know, the dialogue between Sam and Frodo is bad. I just think, like I was saying with the musicals, when I watch a musical and they're singing to each other, I'm out. And I think it's more like that than it's a bad decision.
Yeah. The dialogue in the books, the parts that I've read of the Hobbits talk like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's to serve as a contrast. Their purity is meant to serve as such a contrast to the dark, disgusting, vile orcs and the evilness of Sauron and his army and the Nazgul and the dead that have to, like, work for eternity for this guy, blah, blah, blah. So it's meant to be a contrast, and I know that it's awkward, but it's kind of like, if we were pure at heart, wouldn't we look at each other and say, ah, my Sean, ah, my Bob?
Maybe not with the accent.
I have no problem telling you guys I love you both, but and saying it without it sounding weird or awkward. Have you guys watched The Simpsons, right?
Yes,
of course.
It's like when you listen to Sam and Frodo talk, isn't it like both characters are Martin Prince?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know who Martin Prince is.
Okay, well, that's a deep cut for Simpsons fans. But it's the perfect. It's basically like both characters are half Martin Prince.
Yeah, I kind of know what you're saying. But again,
there's even a scene where he does he and the bully get paired up together, and he does a little dance where he's dancing around the bully and singing about them being friends. And that's kind of how I imagine every inch of this movie is both Sam and Frodo are singing in their heads what great friends they are.
But I'm with John. I don't think it's a mistake or something wrong with the movie. I just think it's one of those things that's not for me more than anything else.
My son watched this for the first time. He's been reading the book. He got farther than I ever got with it, which is something to say. He's the one that pointed out to me the Helm's Deep thing, that the battle was actually earlier in the book. And he watched it this weekend, and he said, boy, I really liked it. And my favorite part was when Gollum was talking to himself. Now, that scene is pretty incredible, because it does seem like he's talking to an entirely different character. The way that the shot is lined up, on one side, you've got Gollum, and the camera's more focused on the right, and then the other shot is Smeagol focused on the left. Now, it's a simple little trick with the camera. I'm not saying that Peter Jackson had any innovation here, but I really got the sense, as opposed to other ways of doing it where they show both characters CGI'd in, you clearly get that dichotomy of Gollum, like, constantly battling inside for dominance. I mean, we love the Hulk for that. I love Gollum for that too, more so, because Gollum's struggle is hundreds of years long, and it's the best version of Jekyll and Hyde, for example, that I know in literature.
I think it's definitely effective. I will say I'm shocked at how much technology has advanced since this movie has come out, because I do remember that being one of the cooler parts of the movie is Gollum, and I mean, like you said, you could, I mean, you already said it, so I don't feel like I'm breaking any news, but you could definitely tell it was not, that it had been dated a little
bit. Yeah, it's
And it's
weird.
Not that old. That's, that was what's crazy to me about it.
It's Studio Weta is the one that worked on the special effects for this film, and at the time, they were lauded for their innovation, and... Yeah, it, to me, I was like, oh, fine, we're finally getting into that age where CGI is matching the humans and I don't have to cringe anymore, right? And then here we are. I'm watching this film 16 years later and I'm kind of cringing because things look awkward. I don't know if that's because of the transfer from a big old screen down to a smaller screen.
And that's part of the possible, and the 4K elements to it too. And
well, yeah, this is a pretty big tangent, but I watched, there's something you guys got to see sometime. There's this guy named H Bomber Guy on YouTube. He did a thing called Scanline, where he's talking about VHS and the way that things have changed. He was talking about the differences between letterbox and pan and scan. Yeah. And but he was talking about how Aliens on VHS in some ways is superior because the screen is smaller and the shadows make it harder to see. And then when you clear it up on a 4K TV and you can see clearly that there isn't an alien directly behind the characters at any given time, it takes some of the tension away. Not that it's bad, because it looks great, but it's what he's talking about. He still loves it, but there's a difference. Watching it on VHS with that darkness, with that extra shadow, with that smaller box, it actually made the tension of Alien that much more exciting. And I can see where, you know, watching Lord of the Rings on a 4K, where now suddenly the outline of Gollum appears,
right. Yeah.
It changes it. Like the reaction that a lot of people had to watching The Hobbit on that that even more advanced thing kind of ruined The Hobbit for a lot of people.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely onto something. I've always wondered why does it not feel the same watching some of my favorite films from youth? And of course, growing up is part of it. But watching Aliens on a beta cassette, okay. It was so clear to me at the time, and now I'm looking back on it, like part of my viewing experience were the flaws of recording from HBO to a beta cassette. The same with Star Wars. Like, Star Wars cleared up is just not nearly as cool as watching the 600th viewed copy taped from TV, you know?
Oh, that's me and Lethal Weapon and Rocky IV.
There you go.
Like, even like my version of Rocky IV, that stupid speech he gives at the end, we accidentally cut it off. So it ends before you can change. Everybody can change. And Lethal Weapon, everybody's an airhead instead of an asshole, and there's no nudity in it. It's,
yeah. You know, I've told the story on the podcast before. Our copy of Ghostbusters, my parents tried to get they tried too hard to fit three onto one. And the end of Ghostbusters, where the marshmallow explodes, okay, and then you see the top of the building, that's when the tape cuts out. And so until I was 17, 18 years old, I didn't know how Ghostbusters ended. We could have just rented the damn thing, but I don't know.
So you got the Phoebe from Friends ending.
Yes. The old Yeller version.
Well, it's like, you know, a CD that gets a scratch in it. Eventually, you know the song with a scratch, you know?
Yes. Every time you hear the song, you're like, oh, this is the part where it skips. Oh, no, whoa,
and
whoa,
it's just
not
the same when it doesn't skip.
No. Well, we went off on a nice little tangent there.
But yeah, I mean, I'll say what I said about Fellowship of the Rings. It's clearly, I mean, I recognize it as a good movie. I'm just not the target audience for it. And it's not painful. It's just it's something where I can go, I get it, but I don't.
Sure. If there's one thing that I know for sure after watching these two is that I love them, but I was trying to put so much prestige on them when they came out. Like, these are all-time classics now. I don't think they are. I think that they're specific to audiences more than Star Wars, even. Like, I heard that Lord of the Rings, that trilogy, was now like the new Star Wars trilogy. Clerks 2, they have the argument, right? Okay, so I think that lends some credence to my thought here. But it's not. It's not the same thing.
Star Wars is much more all-inclusive. You can come into Star Wars pretty much any age and find something to enjoy. But Lord of the Rings is much more insular. It is much more its own. It's got it's way more of its own dialogue. It's way more of its own thing, really. And if you're not on that vibe, you're not in this movie. And I'm sure I'm not. I know that because I'm not on the vibe of this movie at all. But I love Star Wars.
But yeah, you said it. But I mean, it's still a hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's not like its audience is a small audience by any stretch of the word.
But at the same time, though, I mean, how often the people who actually go back to it and care about it and love it the way Josh does is a relatively small group.
I think so. I think it is. For example, they're developing a new Lord of the Rings series for Amazon, right? And there's a huge budget for it, but it's still on Amazon. We're not talking about a brand new Lord of the Rings trilogy or something post Lord of the Rings to get the rights for, like Star Wars. Disney spent, you know, how many billions of dollars to get it. No one's going to do that for Lord of the Rings because I don't think the same audience is there. There's no merchandise line that goes with this.
I agree with you guys on Star Wars. I'm just saying it's a lot bigger than I think it's bigger than it is small. But I think it. I think there's two different types of audiences here. You have that, you know, the literature audience is more, and then you have the Dungeons and Dragons nerds. So you have, you know, and I guess, beyond that too. But
think about it like this: like the size of the tent. The Star Wars tent is way bigger than the Lord of the Rings tent.
I agree.
Yeah. What I meant to bring up with the question is, in reanalyzing that, is Lord of the Rings, are they classics? Like the original Star Wars trilogy is seen as a classic. I mean, those movies even make their way onto AFI lists, for example. Not that that's the be-all, end-all, but there's no Lord of the Rings films on there.
Well, actually, Lord of the Rings is on the AFI list.
Well, Jesus, I should fucking read some AFI lists, shouldn't I? Didn't know that.
I mean, I only know that because because the podcast Unspooled with Paul Scheer and Amy Nicholson, they just did Lord of the Rings. Not like
Paul
2 weeks
always
ago.
Trying to get me down.
I would say it's a classic in the sense that, I mean, it's the best of what it's trying to do.
Yes, and when we talk about Return of the King, I still feel strongly in my mind, even though I haven't seen it for 7-8 years, maybe. That is by far the best of the three films, and that you will like it the most, and that it edges towards that classic, even if it doesn't have an ending. Anyways.
Or if it's got four of them.
Yeah. I try not to think about that. It's perfect. I can't think of it as anything other than perfect.
But I also think because the books are such classics, too, that somehow there's carryover and crossover there that does make it a classic, and
yeah, I suppose so. Though I can tell you, though, I've read Fellowship of the Ring, and boy, does that suck ass. I mean,
well, I've read the Bible. Holy and that sucks, but
no, I would read the Bible any day over Fellowship of the Ring. Wow, whew, stunningly bad.
I've never read the Bible. I'm just kidding. I've read parts of it.
Which parts?
Revelations.
Yeah, I was going to say the ones with the most death and destruction.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in
1988.
Speaking of death and destruction. three films, two that actually were released on this weekend 30 years ago. The first one, we should tie this into the Gerard Butler discussion because Michael Dudikoff had a film that turned 30 called Platoon Leader. Okay, not Platoon,
it's a
but
sequel,
Platoon
though, right?
Leader. No, it's not. He plays a guy that is in charge of a bunch of people. They don't respect him, so he comes back after some seasoning, and he's all of a sudden in charge of them, and everyone respects him now. Okay, fine. It's a canon film. It stars him. I have seen three Michael Dudikoff canon films since we started this podcast. I decided not to do a fourth for a very good reason. American Ninja was hilarious and awesome. Everything else that I've seen with him in it is just god-awful and unwatchable, and he has no screen presence at all.
It does sound like he could nail the first half of this movie, though.
Oh, yeah, not being respected? Yes, absolutely. No, again, let's try and get this guy on the show as we've tried to do before. He's readily available, you know. As much of a heartthrob as he
does have his own website.
Yes, he does.
He never responds to my questions. So.
But did you watch Platoon Leader?
I've seen Platoon Leader years ago, but it's been a very long time.
I did watch a lot of Dudikoff
as a child.
Yeah. Coming to him as an adult, I don't know why he was ever cast in anything. Like, he's adept at martial arts. Okay, he's got a nice muscular body, but the sound that comes out of that hulking man's mouth is just too tiny to be a legitimate movie star. I mean, I'm trying to be honest here. Right. You can't really take him seriously. So, you're right. The film would have worked.
To tie back into mid-90s, I watched them because my brother enjoyed bad action movies, and I thought he actually liked them, so I watched those movies.
And Dolph Lundgren and Jean-Claude Van Damme didn't quite have a presence yet, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. I will say this. I would watch American Ninja again before I watched Universal Soldier.
Oh, you're crazy.
No. American Ninja is hilarious.
So was Universal Soldier. My heart was broken as you were not having as much fun as Sean and I were when we watched that.
Yeah, I guess my love for Emmerich has waned, you know? That's really what it is. Anyways, also in 88, a movie called Feds, starring Rebecca De Mornay and, oh, I forgot her name again because she's Mary Gross. That's the co-star's name. And they're both FBI recruits. Now, this movie makes very clear that they've had to include women in the training as part of their mandate, but they're not expected to do well at all. The leader of the division says exactly that. Now, I like this film a lot, actually, far more than I expected to, and is something that at home was told to me, like, oh, you're going to like this. You're going to like this. I'm like, it's called Rebecca De Mornay. Come on. No, I'm not going to like this. Actually, it's really smart. It's really, really well constructed. And yes, it might be typical as to the progression of these characters, but I liken it to films like Big Business that we talked about earlier in the summer. And Johnny Dangerously is another one that comes to mind. Movies that are quick-witted and have smart characters doing things that you don't expect them to do all around makes this like an incredibly enjoyable movie. Now, I was surprised as shit to see that it was on the same level as all of those movies I just talked about. But sometimes this podcast shows me crap that, like, there were some really smart, intelligent people writing movies back in the 80s. This is one of them.
This is a weird one because it is, because it shouldn't be any good from looking at it, but it actually kind of is. And it's partly because Mary Gross was on SNL. She was one of the those people who got killed off by Lorne Michaels. But she was like, she played like Pee Wee Herman on the show. She was like their utility player. She would show up on Weekend Update. She was pretty incredible. And they didn't quite use her to her full talents. And you get to see a little bit more of her in this movie than they ever gave you on SNL. And she's much, much better a comedian than anybody gave her credit for. And Rebecca De Mornay is just so great. She's just fantastic. She's sexy and funny and, yeah, I'm totally still in love with her after all these years.
Have you seen Feds?
No.
Okay. The last thing I'll say about it is you expect that a film in the 80s, as dated as it might be regarding relationships and female leads, that these two would magically find husbands by the end of the film, and that would be the thing. We didn't make the FBI, but boy, we sure got husbands. Neither of them ends up with a man. And there's the film even kind of hints at it. Like, there are people that are interested in them, but they do everything on their own. And at the end of the film, they legitimately state their case to be part of the FBI. It's just kind of a little progressive and
timely movie.
Yeah. Like, that's the way that it should be. I'm just saying in 1988, it's surprising, sure, and preferred. It was a surprising movie experience. And, okay, on the other side of the coin.
the regressive version.
The regressive version. Cherry 2000 doesn't turn 30 this weekend, but it's part of a group of films that aren't on the normal website that I draw for this segment. And I remember seeing this on HBO a lot when I was younger. A lot. It was one of those like late afternoon, early evening things before they showed the good movie. So they had to sneak one of them in. And I remember falling in love with Melanie Griffith as a result of this movie. She's got red hair in it. You would think that because of that, she's the titular character. She's not, though. The Cherry 2000 is a android model that the lead character named, I forget, Sam is his name, played by David Andrews, a just awful actor. He's atrocious. He really is. He's worse than Dudikoff. Serious. I'm sorry. We're not going to have David Andrews on the podcast either, so I can just go ahead and say that. Unless he has his own website and really wants to be on.
Look, you continue.
But he's looking for his companion robot, a.k.a. sex robot, that breaks down on him because they make sweet love in the middle of a bunch of bubbles, and it destroys his droid. Well, of course it does, you moron. So he hires a bounty hunter, played by Melanie Griffith, to go into the wastelands to acquire another chassis, which he can plug the memory of his old love robot into. Now, that sounds completely ridiculous, right? This is a B-movie. Let's not make any mistake. It sounds
really gross,
yeah. It sounds gross. Everyone's on the same page, though, and you've got 7 movies going on in this one. There's a Western. There's science fiction. There's talk about androids. This has got a little bit of Total Recall and Blade Runner and Mad Max. And it doesn't know how to focus, but I have a lot of fun with it because Melanie Griffith is not being taken advantage of in this movie like you might think she would be. And this was actually filmed back in 1985 and took 2+ years to get out into theaters. I actually really love Cherry 2000 because it's bad. I know it's bad, and I still loved it.
The only thing I remember about this movie is being extraordinarily angry at the lack of boobs.
Yeah.
Because I remember watching this waiting for Melanie Griffith boobs. Because I was, 12 years old, so this is the prime time for that. But I had seen Something Wild. Now I know this woman that I'm very attracted to has shown her boobs in a movie before, so I've got to watch this one now for boobs, and no boobs come.
Indeed, there isn't. And as they used to do before films would start, it would tell you what was in it, like language, adult situations, nudity. I saw the N on there, and I stayed tuned. And lo and behold, it really isn't much of anything to write home about. Now, I'm speaking from a 12, 13-year-old right. point of view. But Melanie Griffith doesn't do that. She owns this movie. I mean, there's nothing about it that's really exploitative of her. She's constantly holding her own ground and helping the lead male all the time. So
the outfit a little bit, on the cover of the DVD.
On the cover of the DVD, that is ridiculous. Okay, the poster is insane and doesn't give a clue to her character at all. But at the only point in this movie where she's kind of getting nude, she doesn't give a crap that there's a dude in the room. She's confident that she can beat the crap out of him, so she just starts to get changed in front of him. And that's, again, it's refreshing. I started to enjoy this film because it wasn't so gross that I couldn't take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's 88. Does David Andrews have his own website?
No, but I found his contact information.
Great. I can talk to him and tell him about how bad he was in Terminator 3 also.
He's in a lot of movies. A lot of movies.
No doubt. He looks perfect for the JAG audience.
He was on an episode of JAG.
I'm sure he was. No idea. Him and Mark Harmon together, it's like separated at birth.
He was in Fight Club. He was in Apollo 13. Wyatt Earp. Cherry 2000. A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Have you seen Cherry 2000, Bob?
Nope.
I asked because as a fan of Mad Max Fury Road, it's not Mad Max Fury Road, okay?
I didn't know I was a fan when that came out.
Sure. There are just elements of Mad Max's nihilistic sensibilities in this film.
There's an element of every sci-fi movie in this film.
It's a mishmash of things, but other movies where there's a mishmash of things, like Independence Day, you're like, there's aliens, there's Close Encounters. They're not doing it they're only doing it like an Easter egg. It's a movie full of Easter eggs, whereas this one is like, we're doing our own thing, and you're going to be your job to keep up with us, regardless of how close it looks to Total Recall or Terminator or whatever. Total Recall hadn't even come out.
I was going to say, when did Total Recall come out? Total Recall ripped off Cherry 2000.
Yeah.
His last job was on a show called Cocked on TV.
Oh, is David Andrews dead?
No.
He just hasn't acted since then.
Okay.
2015, not that
it's,
old.
It's hard to get time off from the from McDonald's to...
He was in World War Z.
I'm kidding.
No, come on. Let's up the ante.
No, he had a long career.
Yeah. When I was pointing out in the room as we were watching it, I'm like, oh, that's it's Claire Danes' dad from Terminator 3. She's like, oh, yeah. Like,
But you said that's 88?
Yeah, that's 88.
All right, next week we've got Bohemian Rhapsody, Nobody's Fool, and the Nutcracker movie. Our classic is Ray, and our top five is concert films.
It's going to be a category that I hope gets some attention for knowledge purposes.
I hope you sit down and watch The Last Waltz.
And I have definitely heard of that one. It's one that we've considered on this show. Now, that's about the band, am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I only know
Bob Dylan, and it was directed by Scorsese.
And I knew the Scorsese angle, but I only know one song by the band, and everyone knows that one song. So is it worth digging deeper into their music? It
absolutely is.
Okay. Excellent.
But, you know, then there's The Wall, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff to pick from.
Does The Wall count as a concert film?
Kind of.
Oh, would the Song Remains the Same be considered a concert?
That's definitely
film?
A concert. Yeah. Film. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can kind of it can be a loose definition of concert.
Pearl Jam
film.
20,
and of course, Rattle and Hum is turning 30. So yeah. Then
that's the onus for actually picking the category. Is the
actually the YouTube more Pearl Jam concert films? The Chicago Cubs one, where they actually play music instead of just be a documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, I either way. But yeah, that is our show. As always, I want to thank our Patreon supporters. Up here are Key Grip Levels, Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing. I'm in another. Our character actors, Cousin Jeff, Christina Cato, and Josh Paul.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Sarah Ward and Corey from Ivy Envy.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer is Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars are Uncle Jeff and Dave Sievers.
I want the truth! Can't handle the truth.
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help us out. And tell friends, help us grow the show. We will be releasing the time travel one within the next month. So that's kind of a taste of what our Patreon episodes are like. And then we'll try to get a couple more bonus episodes out as well when we have time. Otherwise, we will see you next week.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best friends that...
All right, Raising Arizona or The Others?
Raising Arizona.
Agreed.
Yeah. Love Actually or The Abyss?
Love Actually.
Agreed.
310 to Yuma, 2007, or Shrek the Third?
310 to Yuma.
Agreed.
The Karate Kid or Tomb Raider 2? 2003, The
Cradle of Life.
Which Karate Kid?
84.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Agreed.
If it had been the Jaden Smith one, I might have gone the other way.
I would have stuck with it.
La Vie en Rose? I don't know what that
La
is.
La Vie en Rose.
Let's get that one up. I mean, it was an Oscar winner, but...
The Perfect Storm or The Matrix?
I really like The Perfect Storm, but I'll go with The Matrix.
I also will.
It's amazing to me, though, how forgotten The Perfect Storm is. Like, totally completely forgotten that movie is.
It was released at a weird time. That was the last film that I saw at the Milan Cinema.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. In 2000, and it didn't close down until February of 2002.
I don't know what the last movie I saw there was.
If I had known that it was going to close, I obviously would have gone to more from August of 2000 to February of 2002, but the new spanking theater was open, you know, in Davenport, and so...
You're the reason it shut down.
Yes. Trust me, I blame myself all the time. No, I found out by wanting to go see E.T. re-released early in February of 2002. I drove into the parking lot to try and get tickets, and there was cardboard over the plywood over the doors. I mean, I lost my mind. It was a pretty emotional moment to see that your like childhood Oasis is gone. Like, wow. That was a rough phone call. I called my mom and was like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't take you to see this movie because I'm an idiot and I live closer than you to this place, but it's closed.
That's funny. The Peanuts movie or Top Gun?
Top Gun.
Top Gun.
I'm still very proud of our Peanuts episode.
I don't remember. What was the special thing about that?
I remember just Sean loving the movie and then me sending Charlie Brown through real life
afterwards. Of course.
Yeah, I probably should have picked Peanuts movie now that you mentioned it.
Desperado or Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone?
That's hard. It's been a while since I've seen Desperado. Desperado, I guess.
I'll go with Harry Potter.
It's Desperado for me. Thumb and Louise or The Perfect Storm?
Again, I love Perfect Storm, but Thumb and Louise is just kind of better.
Yeah.
I'll vote against Ridley Scott here. I'll go with The Perfect Storm.
I'll go with Thumb and Louise as well. There's just too many damn storm movies.
But that was the original.
They all seem to be pretty good, though, too. Every time we have a trailer, Sean's like, this is going to suck. And then he comes back, he's like, this is pretty good.
Right.
Yeah. Which one?
Adrift would be the most recent one.
Adrift, okay.
Always Lost?
Yeah, the one with the guy from Star Trek.
The one with the guy from The Hobbit, though, in the lead, that was pretty awful.
Martin Freeman?
No, dwarf guy. Richard Armitage. That Ooh. Piece of shit weather movie he made.
Oh, I didn't know he was in a weather movie.
Oh, yeah.
Even Hurricane Heist he kind of liked.
It's so bad it's good.
Still. Death Proof or The Fountain?
Death Proof.
Death Proof.
Yeah. Oh, poor Josh. Two of his top five for this week's episode. The Crow or Demolition Man?
It's The Crow.
The Crow easily, believe it or not.
It's Demolition Man, but I haven't seen The Crow in a really long time. I haven't seen it since the very first time I watched it.
That is an actual classic.
So I've gotten so far away from that that I have no frame of reference. Training Day or Alien 3?
Training Day.
Alien 3.
Training Day. And I don't like Training Day.
That is one of the most overrated experiences I've ever had watching a movie. I saw it on video. You know, everyone had talked it up. He'd won his Oscar by then, and it was like...
I was so annoyed he won. I almost thought it was more racist that he won his Oscar, because it was just like...
Was that the year that Halle Berry also won? And
okay. Did they give Sidney Poitier the Lifetime Achievement? It was just like, come on, Hollywood. You guys are pathetic. Avengers or Face Off?
two wonderful experiences in totally different ways. Avengers.
I can eat a peach for hours. It's one of my favorite quotes of all time from a movie. I mean, it's so gross.
Especially now that Calling by Your Name's come out. There's got to be a mashup somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, so when Armie Hammer comes into the room, you dub it with Nicolas Cage's voice.
Oh, God.
We don't want to take that beautiful film and destroy it.
Doesn't Nicolas Cage talk about destroying something beautiful? I think he does.
He has before.
Yeah.
I can hear it in my head. I just don't know where.
I just wanted to destroy something beautiful.
Put that in American Beauty. Just him beating up a bag. To Kill a Mockingbird or Signs?
Signs.
To Kill a Mockingbird. That's your fault.
Yeah, I think it is To Kill a Mockingbird, but I really like Signs.
Signs is just personal because of the experience of seeing it the way I saw it. It was pretty awesome.
The Graduate or Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels?
Oh, fuck. Fishing with Gandhi.
I'll go with The Graduate. I get it, but I still enjoy it, the music so much.
I'll go with The Graduate, but I don't mind Lock, Stock. Terminator Salvation or Alien Resurrection?
Fourth films and sagas.
You've already wasted Gandhi. Your fishing with Gandhi.
That's actually a good rule. You can only use one fishing with Gandhi.
Fuck. What is it again?
Terminator Salvation or Alien Resurrection?
Salvation versus Resurrection.
Terminator.
I'm also going Terminator Salvation.
I haven't seen either one of them, so go right ahead. The Insider or Seven?
Oh, fuck. Those are two awesome movies. But Seven.
Seven.
Yeah. The Lone Ranger, 2013, or Eyes Wide Shut?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, I didn't see The Lone Ranger, but I'm sure that it would be Eyes Wide Shut. Not really going to have a chance.
All right. Step Brothers, I'll be choosing that one. Or Gross Point Blank.
Gross Point Blank.
Gross Point Blank.
Normally, I don't give my selection because it's already decided. But all right, this should be easy. Blade Trinity or The Silence of the Lambs?
Silence of the Lambs.
Silence.
Back to the Future Part 3 or Billy Madison?
Oh, Back to the Future.
Part 3.
Part 3, yeah. Yes. Even Part 3 over that.
It's closer than it should be, but Back to the Future.
It is kind of a coin flip for me as well. Toys or The Thin Red Line?
Thin Red Line.
Is interminably boring as The Thin Red Line is to me. It's the first Malick movie that I saw, so I needed some training. I should probably go back to it. Toys was the first date movie that I ever went on. And, oh, it couldn't have been a worse date either. So I'm going to go with Thin Red Line just for the memory. It's also, Toys is bad.
My first date movie was like 6 years later.
I got out there early, you know.
Oh, I had Meet Joe Black. That was brutal.
That's so
brutal.
Good.
That movie's awful. That movie's terrible.
But that first 5 minutes is fantastic.
Oh God! And I was on a terrible date too. So she loved it. Oh God! It was a nightmare.
Mine was The Rainmaker, which nobody remembers.
I kind of like that movie.
I went on a date with that movie too. Good job.
We were probably 1997.
It was in Milan. I have the ticket at home.
Yeah. And I believe the next date movie was Armageddon.
Oh, wow.
Oh, there's a long gap there. Did you have problems?
Same girl. She actually had a boyfriend during the first date. I was like, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm not coming back. Go on. Break up with him first. Death Proof or The Mummy?
Death Proof.
99 Mummy, not...
If we're the 32 Mummy, it would be closer for me, but... Death Proof is really awesome.
Yeah, it's Death Proof.
Yeah. Paranormal Activity 2 or What Women Want?
Which one makes me want to vomit less? Paranormal Activity 2.
I'm using my fishing with Gandhi. Because I actually saw Paranormal Activity 2. That's where I stopped. And I really hate What Women Want. One of the worst theater experiences. The whole nine yards. Well, that's a different movie. That was a good theater experience. I'll shut up now.
The whole nine yards.
I really liked The Whole Nine Yards. That was really fun.
Me too.
Yeah. I don't mind What Women Want. It's not good, but...
It's a Nancy Meyers film.
Black Christmas 2006 or Chuck-a-Lot?
Black Christmas.
I haven't seen the update of Black Christmas, but I was just explaining to my son why he doesn't want to see the Nutcracker, because Lasse Hallström directed it, and I was talking about Chocolat and Cider House Rules.
I want to collect all the copies of Chocolat and just burn them, just melt them down like chocolate, and then pour them in the streets.
Oh, man, I don't want chocolate.
I'm not allowed to have chocolate.
Yeah, I know. Healthy, good eater, and healthy person.
Not really. Ben and Jerry's is non-dairy, so I can technically eat that. Not good for you.
But
tastes fine.
Yeah.
Well, you got to get away from the good stuff for a while, and then it tastes amazing.
I see. That's the trick. Okay.
Coyote Ugly or The Matrix?
The Matrix.
Matrix.
Snakes on a Plane or Rain Over Me?
Rain Over Me for the half of that that's actually good.
Snakes on a Plane.
It's Rain Over Me. It's
Snakes on a Plane scared the shit out of me. It shouldn't. It's bad. It's stupid. And the snakes are bad too, but it scared me.
Did you participate in the Samuel L. Jackson will call you to make you go see this movie? You could go in and type a phone number in, and Samuel L. Jackson would call into a voicemail saying, "Hey, get out and see Snakes on a Plane." And he'd say your name. It was just a recording. It was stupid as hell, but
that's awesome. I didn't do that, but that was about the time that I was playing with soundboards a lot, and I did have a good Samuel L. Jackson soundboard where I would call others as his name.
Did he call you a motherfucker?
I think he says motherfucker at some point in it. I mean, the whole legend behind that movie is better than the movie itself.
Oh, way better.
They changed the name. We're going to make it PG-13. And
yeah, but the snakes, there's so many of them, and you just put yourself in that situation. And
I don't know if I put myself into the studio room where they're deciding whether to make a PG-13 or not. That's the only situation I could get into when I watch that
movie. It's rated R.
I know, but they were...
Okay.
Have you heard the story behind it?
No.
They were going to change the name to United 452 or whatever the hell the name of the plane was. They were going to make it was going to be rated R, then they decided to go PG-13, and Samuel Jackson said, "I need to say at least once, get these motherfucking things." Yes. They added that after the fact, and he goes, "You need to call it Snakes on a Plane," and there's had a bunch of internet buzz behind it, and it came out and just kind of disappeared. It didn't do anything that...
Well, it's a successful film, though. If you look at the budget box office, successful.
But it wasn't.
I'm surprised there was never a sequel. Snakes on a Train.
Wasn't even the number. Well, I think there kind of is.
That movie does exist, but not in the same universe, yeah.
Zombieland or Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Ferris Bueller.
The World Series just ended. Did you know that Walker Bueller of the LA Dodgers, his Twitter handle is Bueller's Day Off? He became a favorite of mine once I saw that.
Zombieland. Yeah. I like Ferris Bueller, okay. All right, we're really long. Podcast over.